clean flapping of canvas. He glanced at the groom, a well-built man in his mid-30s dressed in a slate gray tux.
"Are you ready?"
The groom nodded, flashing a nervous smile. Flagg nodded to one of the crew. Wedding music began. The crowd stood, turning in unison to gaze at the bride and her parents, who were escorting her up the steps from the quarterdeck.
"A perfect afternoon for a wedding,"
the captain declared, at the same time wondering why the bay appeared so empty. Whipping its crescent tail in frenetic sweeps, the megalodon zigzagged along the murky bottom in a continuously widening pattern as its senses probed the bay for an alternative escape route. Trapped in a maze, the crazed animal raced inland like a mad bull, only to be forced back by the shallows. Banking sharply, the fish then headed for the inlet, veering off at the last moment as it approached the gillnets, scattering the five remaining male great whites trapped within its presence. Jonas, Mac, and the crew of the damaged fishing trawler watched in fear and amazement as the 8-foot wake created by the submerged leviathan continued rolling across the surface of the shallow bay.
"She's trapped and she knows it," Mac said.
Jonas eyed the Lady Washington, now closing to within 500 yards of the trawler. Through binoculars, he could see the vessel's 170 tons displacing water as she rolled in full splendor along the glass-smooth surface.
"Angel will go after the sailing ship," Jonas whispered.
"Why?" Mac asked. "The William Beebe's about the same size and she hasn't gone after that."
"The William Beebe's steel and has churning propellers. The Lady Washington moves up and down through the sea like a big whale. Angel's panicking. Her sensory system is so overloaded right now that her instincts will be to attack anything that crosses her path."
Approaching the Westport Marina pier, the megalodon banged sharply, forced to retreat once more from the shallows. Moving into the deeper waters bordering the inlet, the predator raced along the curtain-like gillnet, snaring a 16-foot, 2,200-pound great white in its jaws. With a violent chomp, Angel's teeth severed her distant cousin into three mangled pieces, the male's tail and head spinning toward the seafloor. Without slowing, the exhausted hunter banked again, homing in on a new source of vibrations from a larger adversary moving along the surface.
"Then, with the power vested in me by the State of Washington, the United States Coast Guard, and as captain of the Lady Washington, I now pronounce you husband and wife. You may now kiss the bride."
Caught in the background, Flagg held a frozen smile as a photographer clicked off a half-dozen pictures of the newlyweds kissing. He watched the couple make their way down the aisle to the reception area on the main deck, then turned to his left, a movement in the bay catching his eye.
"What in the hell?"
The rogue wave seemed to be rolling straight for them. Flagg stood at the guardrail, catching sight of a pale object streaking below the surface seconds before the Lady Washington was hammered broadside with a resounding thud. Before he could react, the wake washed over the main deck amid the sounds of splintering wood, the great ship rolling sideways. Screams filled the air as startled passengers fell hard onto the wooden deck. The buffet tables tumbled over, a butane burner actually starting a small fire before an alert guest smothered it. The ship's bosun and one of her purses ran to Flagg.
"Captain, what hit us?"
"I don't know. Keep the passengers calm. I'm going below deck to check the damage."
Flagg climbed down through the hatch in the quarterdeck, descending to the middle deck. Water sprayed in through tiny gaps along splintered planks just above the floorboards. Grabbing a flashlight, he headed below to the lower deck.
"Oh, Christ!"
The lower deck was already submerged in 7 feet of water. Flagg climbed down, then ducked underwater, focusing his light along the far side. It didn't take him long to find the damage. What had once been the wall of the galley was now an 8-foot gaping hole rapidly venting the ship to the sea. Flagg emerged from the water and gasped for air, shaken by the sight of the damage. What could have caused such an impact? He realized that he had to seal the upper hatches right away, knowing the ship could be on the bottom within minutes. He started up the ladder. Without warning, the Lady Washington was pummeled sideways as if struck by a runaway locomotive, the jolt tossing Flagg backward into the water. Opening his eyes, he was shocked to see a second hole in the splintered wall. He swam over to the gap and peered through. The captain's heart pounded in his ears as his eyes focused on the luminescent ivory snout. The creature shook its head, then glided away through the murky water. Flagg dragged himself back up the ladder just ahead of the rising sea, slamming the hatch closed behind him. For several seconds he simply stood there, doubled over and dripping wet, his mind trying to fathom the size of the monster that was attacking his vessel. He looked up as the bosun and purser descended from the main deck.
"Captain, what's hitting us?"
"You don't want to know. Listen to me, both of you. This boat's going down very fast. I want you to seal every hatch, then get back up on deck and start loading everyone into the life rafts."
The purser, a volunteer who worked for room and board, seemed bewildered.
"Sir, we're abandoning ship?"
"No, son, the ship's abandoning us. She'll be on the bottom in less than 5 minutes. Now move!"
The crew of the trawler watched helplessly as the sail-like dorsal fin rose above the wake, circling the crippled sailing ship. Jonas crouched in the cockpit of the down chopper, yelling over the radio.
"Damn it, Marin, I said I wanted to speak with Celeste."
"Forget it, Taylor. We're not retracting the nets. The Megalodon's exhausted, and the William Beebe's on the way to Harpooner. We'll pick up any passengers in the water, but we're not..."
Deef entered the pilot house and tore the radio away from Marin.
"Jonas, it's Deef. What the hell's going on?"
The chopper lost its tail assembly. "Deef, that sail ship's going down fast. There must be 50 passengers on board. You got to retract those gillnets. The Meg's going berserk."
"I'm on it."
Jonas rejoined Mac on deck. 200 yards away, the Lady Washington had managed to turn leeward, its prow straining to reach the disabled fishing trawler, its 11-foot draft now less than 2 feet above water.
"They'll never make it," Mac said. "Shit, here she comes again."
Jonas cringed as the wake barreled into the Lady Washington, the ship shuddering as it absorbed yet another tremendous blow. He could hear the screams of the passengers. A tremendous crack, and the towering mainmast toppled forward like a fallen redwood. Terrified passengers looked up and saw they were about to be crushed. To their relief, the collapsing mainsails struck the foremast, causing the fractured mainmast to twist sideways and slam into the bay with a tremendous splash. 78-year-old Emily Wheeler struggled to her knees, the bride's grandmother attempting to free herself from the fallen topsail that held her pinned to the deck.
"Help me, please!"
"Mom? Mom, where are you?"
Hugh Wheeler, the father of the bride, pulled aside the canvas, lifting his frail mother off the Lady Washington's deck, which was now listing at a 30-degree angle to starboard. Wheeler saw Flagg running toward the two life rafts and practically tackled him.
"Captain, I demand to know what the hell is happening!"
"What's happening? What's happening is that there's a very large shark out there who doesn't seem to like our boat."
"A shark? I can't believe a shark could..."
Flagg saw water rising out from several hatches.
"Mr. Wheeler, there's no time to debate the issue. I need help getting our guests in the life rafts."
Wheeler took his mother by the arm, practically carrying her across the flooded deck. His wife and daughter waved at him from one of the two inflatable life rafts, already crammed with hysterical passengers. Flagg blew his whistle as loud as he could.
"Now listen here. The Lady Washington is about to sink. I want everyone seated in a life raft within the next 30 seconds. It's vital all of you remain as calm and quiet as possible. There's a very large shark out there, and the last thing I want is to let it know where we are."
The William Beebe raced across the bay, 500 yards and closing fast on the dying sail ship. Harry Moon and Dr. Marin quickly reloaded another tranquilizer into the barrel of the harpoon gun, while Deef and Celeste supervised the emergency launch of the Abyss glider. As Deef opened the rear hatch of the tiny Kevlar submersible, he turned to Celeste and Captain Morgan.
"I'll lure the Meg away and give you a chance to rescue those people. Then lead her back around so you'll get a good shot."
He crawled into the Lexan pod of the AG-1, sealing himself in. Through binoculars, Jonas focused on the white dorsal fin as it rose up behind the Lady Washington. Water now covered the ship's main deck, the passengers and crew hovering in two life rafts lashed to the foremast. Mac grabbed Jonas's arm, pointing to the research vessel now gliding alongside the sinking tall ship.
"Jonas, check out the William Beebe stern. Are they launching the Abyss glider?"
Jonas redirected his glasses in time to see the one-man submersible plunge into the sea. Filled to capacity, the two life rafts remained lashed to the foremast, floating just above the submerged deck of the Lady Washington. Flagg and his passengers stared behind them, horrified by the sight of the wake rolling in behind them. A pearl-white fin emerged from the moving mound of water and kept rising. The snout appeared. Screams as the monster struck the submerged poop deck with a heart-stopping crunch. The impact shattered the keel and fractured the foremast, which toppled backward like a chain-sawed timber. Flagg watched the sickle-shaped caudal fin slash back and forth among the floating debris less than 20 feet away. The creature was searching the perimeter of the sinking ship, which now began to spin, caught within a slow-moving whirlpool. 100 feet of sea separated them from their would-be rescuers.
"The Lady Washington will drag us below!" he yelled. "Loose the lines and paddle toward the rescue ship!"
Abandoning the harpoon gun, Harry Moon helped his crew position a cargo net over the port side of the ship as the two overcrowded life rafts paddled toward them.
"Damn!"
he muttered. The dorsal fin had turned, homing in on the vibrations. Lying prone, secured within the pilot's harness, Deef grabbed the twin joysticks and ignited the sub's main thrusters. Diving at a sharp angle, he descended quickly to the shallow bottom, approaching the hull of the sinking wooden tall ship.
"Jesus!"
An immense hole stared back at him, so large he could have maneuvered the sub straight through and out its fractured keel.
Okay, Shark, where... Oh, fuck.
Seeing the glow, Deef wrenched the joystick hard to his left as a head, the size of a small house, glided out from behind the wreckage. Momentarily panicked, Deef accelerated too quickly, nearly burying the nose of the swift sub in the muddy seabed. Ignoring the sub, the shark ascended. Flying along the bottom, Deef frantically searched the murky water for the monster. Looking up, he saw a frightening silhouette glide like a jumbo jetliner along the sunlit surface, closing in slowly on a yellow life raft. Her decks now completely submerged, the Lady Washington swirled in a great counterclockwise circle, pulling her downed mainsails with her. Flag and his passengers hung on as the two life rafts converged with the surface debris, revolving in the vortex of the sinking mothership. With a sudden jolt, the ship's splintered keel twisted into the shallow muddy bottom. The towering foremast remained upright, marking the sunken ship's position, high above the waves. Emily Wheeler sat shivering at the rear of the life raft, her new dress soaked in seawater. Hugh removed the jacket of his tux and wrapped it around his mother's shoulders.
"You okay, Mom?"
She nodded, her lips blue.
"Just hang on, we'll be on that rescue boat and..."
Without warning, the megalodon snout rose beneath the back of the raft, pushing it upward and out of the water. 28 passengers shrieked, clinging to each other in desperation as they were flipped upside down and tossed into the sea. Emily plunged sideways into the water, the sudden cold shocking her system. Buoyed by the life jacket, she surfaced quickly, struggling to catch her breath. Hugh surfaced next to his wife, hearing her scream, "Carrie can't swim!" Ducking underwater, he saw his daughter flailing below without a life jacket, her long wedding gown spreading out like a parachute, its weight dragging her toward the bottom. Deef looked up to see the Meg bite down on the rubber raft, bursting it in a shower of bubbles as it shook its mammoth head from side to side like a dog, tearing the craft to shreds. Before the predator, spread out along the surface, was a feast of kicking legs and paddling arms. Deef gasped in horror as he saw the bride sinking feet first, her wedding gown and train now entangled around her legs in a death grip. Hugh surface dived and kicked hard, straining to reach his daughter as she continued to sink in 20 feet of water. Missing her arm, he managed to grab a handful of her long hair, momentarily stopping her descent. Gaining a grip on her wrist, he towed her to the surface, struggling to move in clothing that weighed him down like an anchor. As his head broke the water, Hugh was relieved to hear his daughter choking as she gasped for air. Tossing his arm over her chest, he began towing her toward the rescue vessel. He saw the dorsal fin emerge.
"Oh, God! Mom! Mom!"
Hugh cried out in agony as the hellish creature rose directly behind his mother. Directing the nose of the sub at a gap of sunlight, Deef launched his craft between the megalodon snout and the figure of an old woman. With a loud yell, he accelerated the abyss glider vertically at the creature's lower jaw. A strange current gripped Emily, spinning her around into darkness. A quick yelp, and her life was extinguished, her frail form pulverized into mangles of flesh against the roof of the shark's mouth. A second later, the nose cone of the abyss glider smashed hard into the megalodon's quivering throat. Gaining the monster's attention, Deef hit full reverse thrust, spinning away and descending quickly as the formidable creature swallowed its meal and turned to pursue. The passengers of the Lady Washington scrambled over each other as they ascended the heavy cargo net, climbing desperately into the arms of the William Beebe's crew. Hugh Wheeler was the last to reach the ship. Watching his daughter climb to safety, he remained in the water, sobbing at the loss of his mother. Deef zigzagged along the bottom, glancing quickly over his shoulder to make sure he was being followed. The megalodon rammed the tail wing, driving the AG-1 sideways into the mud. Deef rolled the sub, then raced for the surface. Jonas and Mac watched the abyss glider leap from the sea like a sailfish. Seconds later, the creature's head burst the surface, its open jaws snapping shut on empty air as the sub plunged mid-wing first into the bay. Jonas ran to the cockpit and grabbed the radio.
"Celeste, Captain, somebody come in!"
"Jonas, it's Celeste."
"Celeste, you have to order that gill net removed before Deef gets killed."
"Marin is ready to harpoon."
"Listen to me, goddammit. The bay's too shallow. There's no room for Deef to maneuver. Retract those nets before he's killed."
"Okay, okay."
Marin looked up from the harpoon gun to see one of the fishing trawlers begin hauling in the southern end of the gill net.
"Celeste, no!"
"Take your shot, Michael. Just do it quickly."
Deef rolled the sub 360 degrees as the megalodon bit into his portside midwing, shearing off the Kevlar appendage like husk from corn. Knowing he could no longer elude the faster shark, Deef circled back to seek refuge behind the Lady Washington.
the radio crackled.
Div?
Be quick, Celeste.
The southern end of the gill net's open.
Thank God.
Deef turned south, veering away from the Lady Washington, accelerating toward open ocean. A shadow passed overhead. He looked up and screamed as the hideous upper jaw clamped shut on the clear nose cone of his sub. With a tremendous pop, the Lexan bubble imploded, sending a river of water slamming into Deef's face, driving the breath from his chest. A roar, then a sickening crunch, as the Kevlar in Lexan's sub was pulverized around him, a shard from the crushed nose cone slicing deep into his upper arm. The Megalodon released its bite and began circling its prey, waiting for it to die. Deef thrashed in his harness, unable to free himself from the crushing embrace of his upside-down coffin. Reaching to his right, he managed to grab hold of the pony bottle, shoving the regulator into his mouth and opening the valve to the emergency supply of air. After gagging into the mouthpiece, he calmed himself and sucked a life-giving breath. The glow appeared to his left. Looming through swirls of mud, he saw an ivory head drift closer. The snout pushed against the wreckage, pressing against Deef's chest. With both hands, the submersible pilot futilely attempted to push the 62,000-pound behemoth away. A surprisingly strong current caught his left hand, sucking it into a giant nostril. In surreal motion, the mouth stretched open before him, 9-foot maw blotting out the sunlight. Richard Diefendorf said a quick prayer. Then he spat out the regulator and inhaled the sea as the angel of death came for him. Michael Marin swore aloud as the alabaster form streaked past the William Beebe, racing for the southern end of the inlet. After circling twice, the creature finally sensed the obstruction was no longer there. Seconds later, the Megalodon was gone. Risky Business. Mariana Trench. Terry wiped the sweat from her brow, then continued twisting an iron crossbar. Another 15 minutes passed before she was able to wrench one end of the bed frame free. Aided by the additional leverage, the other end followed quickly. She stood, slapping the 2-foot hollow bar in her hand, feeling its weight against her open palm. It wasn't nearly as good as the Russian's hunting knife, but at least she wouldn't be unarmed. Terry checked her watch. 2:10 a.m. She eased open her cabin door and listened. Hearing only the sounds of the Benthos' generators, she crept barefoot into the hall, iron bar held tightly within her right fist, her heart thumping wildly in her chest. Access tube or companionway? The Russian prefers the tube. She tiptoed to the companionway, listening. She could hear the voices of the crew talking in the galley, discussing the immense prehistoric fossil the Prometheus had unearthed hours earlier. Entering the sealed stairwell, Terry lifted the watertight hatch at the base of the staircase and descended quietly, closing the seal behind her. Level F, ship stores, equipment rooms, and the nuclear reactor. Keep going. Terry opened the next companionway hatch, listening carefully before heading down the last flight of stairs which led to G-deck, the only level considered off-limits to all but Benedict's personal staff. She held her breath, again hearing only the hum from the ship's generators. Creeping barefoot across the tile floor, she darted down the empty corridor to the entrance of the submarine docking station. Terry pressed her ear to the watertight door. Realizing the futility of the gesture, she held her breath and pushed open the door, entering the vault. The empty circular room yawned back at her. Heart fluttering, she ran to the conning tower of the Prometheus, protruding out from the center of the docking station floor. Pulling open the sub's outer hatch, she climbed on the ladder and into the vessel. The sub was dark, save for the fluorescent glow coming from dozens of control consoles. She crept forward, listening, terrified at being alone in a docked sub surrounded by 16,000 pounds per square inch of water. Locating the computer console, she sat down, then booted the system. All day, Benedict Singer had infuriated her, playing with her emotions, manipulating her like a puppet. This time, it was her turn. The Geotech menu appeared on the screen, just as it had hours earlier. Using the mouse, she highlighted Tokamak. She was about to press enter when she heard a noise in the docking chamber above. Footsteps. Her heart pounding out of control, Terry searched desperately for a place to hide. She hurried to the rear of the sub, smashing her shin painfully against another console before ducking into the bathroom. She heard the seal open. Whoever was out there was descending into the Prometheus. Terry was convinced it was the Russian. Wiping the sweat from her palms, she gripped the iron bar tightly in both hands and raised it over her head. She could feel the vibrations of the man's footsteps. She heard him pause at the computer station, then continue moving aft, approaching the bathroom. Aim for his head. One good shot. Then don't stop till he's dead. The door began opening. Terry swung the iron bar toward the head of the silhouetted figure.
The man sideswiped the bar, then grabbed her arm and twisted it expertly behind her back. Terry started to scream, but her assailant was too quick, clamping his hand over her mouth and nose, cutting off her breath.
Terry, it's Heath.
The vice-like grip released her. She bent over, gasping for air.
You okay?
He asked. She nodded, still out of breath. Heath inspected the iron rod.
Yeah, this would have hurt.
He handed it back to her.
Better save it for Sergei.
What are you doing here?
I saw you leave your room and figured this might be where you were heading. A very dangerous move. Come here, I want to show you something.
He led her by the arm to the computer station.
The GTI file you were about to access requires a security code. Failing to enter the correct code within 60 seconds would have resulted in all sorts of security devices going off.
Terry stared at the monitor, sweat dripping down both sides of her face.
Why did you follow me? Are you trying to protect me from the Russian?
Heath grinned.
Sergei won't be bothering you tonight. I slipped him a little something in his tea at dinner. Right now, he should be sleeping like a Russian wolfhound. Tell me why you were accessing the Tokamak file.
She sat down next to the computer. Benedict's been toying with me ever since we arrived on board the Benthos, and I'm tired of it. This afternoon was the worst. I don't know if he's intending to let me live or die, but I decided it was my turn to screw with him for a change.
What do you know about Tokamak?
Nothing.
Terry, I can't help you if you lie to me.
I'm not lying. Who are you? Do you really know Jonas? Heath rubbed the sweat from his brow.
I don't know him personally, but we both worked together on a deep-sea project for the Navy about 11 years ago.
11 years? The realization dawned on her.
The Mariana Trench dives?
Heath nodded.
It was a top-secret mission. To this day, Jonas still has no idea what it was really about. Schaefer and Prestes, the two men who died when Jonas panicked in the abyss, they were my colleagues.
So you're with the Navy?
Not anymore.
But you're not a paleobiologist.
Tell me what you know about Tokamak.
CIA?
Terry, I can't help you if you won't cooperate.
You are CIA, aren't you?
Terry, enough. Right now you're endangering both of our lives.
Look, I told you, I really don't know anything about Tokamak. When I was aboard the Goliath, I... She smiled, embarrassed. I guess you could say I did a little covert operating myself. I stumbled across some kind of high-tech lab hidden within the bowels of the Goliath and...
Within the Goliath? Where?
Heath seemed excited.
How are you able to access it? What was inside?
She told him about the stairwell hidden within the ship's old missile silo, then described the lab.
This large machine, Heath asked. Did it look like a giant toroidal? A giant donut?
Yes. How did you know that?
Jesus. Heath rubbed his face again. How familiar are you with fusion?
As in atom bombs?
No, that's fission. Fusion is the process that powers the sun and stars. It occurs when two atoms of hydrogen, usually an isotope of deuterium and one of tritium, are heated at super-hot temperatures until they fuse together, releasing an incredible amount of energy. When this happens, matter enters a new state, plasma.
Heath turned off the computer.
We are probably still a good 25 years away from placing a fusion reactor online, but the potential benefits are enormous. Imagine an energy source that's virtually inexhaustible, environmentally friendly, and produces no combustion products, greenhouse gases, or even byproducts that can be made into weapons.
Sounds too good to be true.
Some bureaucrats might agree. We're still in the experimental phases, and it's very costly, but things are progressing. To make fusion happen, the atoms of deuterium and tritium must be heated to temperatures exceeding 100 million degrees, then be held together long enough for fusion to occur. The sun accomplishes this using gravity. On Earth, we have to use a magnetic field to confine the gases.
So what's a tokamak?
Tokamak means toroidal chamber in Russian. Coils wrapped around the outside of the toroid, or donut, create a magnetic field inside the chamber, which in turn stabilizes the fusion plasma.
Now you're way over my head. Just tell me how Benedict is involved.
Hear me out. The main challenge of fusion is to be able to contain the hot plasma for a sufficient amount of time. This relates to problems with the fuel itself, specifically tritium, which is radioactive. Several years ago, Israeli intelligence learned of a secret meeting between Benedict Singer and Osama bin Laden, exiled Saudi millionaire and financier of the National Islamic Front, a terrorist organization linked to the attack on the World Trade Center, as well as several other bombings, including the ones on the Kenya and Nairobi embassies. At this meeting, Benedict demonstrated a prototype fuel that created a fusion reaction said to have been off the scale of any energy reaction previously accomplished. Bin Laden and his Arab associates were so impressed that they agreed to finance GTI's work in exchange for partial control of the technology. With their backing and influence, Benedict has been able to recruit some of the brightest minds in Russia and the Middle East to help him construct what may turn out to be the world's first true tokamak fusion reactor.
What happens if Benedict succeeds?
If he succeeds, he'll change the balance of power for decades to come. Up to now, fusion has been a shared technology among the world's nations, a united effort to pool our resources for the common good. Fusion would legitimize bin Laden's influence on our entire global economy. It would be the equivalent of Hitler developing the atomic bomb before the United States. It's vital that we determine what Benedict's mysterious fusion fuel source is and whether it's stable. CIA has been following him for years, attempting to infiltrate his organization. We got our first break when Benedict contacted Scripps in search of a paleobiologist.
Obviously, you're not a paleobiologist. Aren't you afraid Benedict will see through the charade?
I have a work and knowledge in the field, enough to get by. So far, things have gone okay, although the first real challenge to my cover just came up.
That fossil?
Yes. The object is an incredible specimen of a prehistoric reptile I've never seen before. Benedict's demanding that I come up with answers to its origin, and fast.
Could it have been related to the species that chased after us today?
Too early to say. I'm probably in way too deep, but I need to provide Benedict with information soon before he suspects something.
What can I do to help?
For one thing, stay the hell away from these computers, Heath advised. The CIA believes that Benedict's fusion fuel may be aboard the Benthos. There's some kind of storehouse located on G-Deck that's off-limits to everyone except Benedict and his piranhas.
If I could just get a look inside, I'd know what he's up to. Wish I could help, but right now I'm just struggling to keep from being killed. Terry gave him a nervous smile. Maybe you could kill Sergei for me, you know, in the line of duty?
I'll run as much interference for you as I can without jeopardizing my cover, but I can't help you unless you stay in your cabin. Tonight was very foolish. I suggest you speak with Benedict about joining him on board the Prometheus again. You know, appeal to his ego. Speak some Latin to him or something. With any luck, you'll be topside in a few days. So no more chances, okay?
Okay. They exited the sub, Heath escorting her back to her quarters. The CIA agent said goodnight, then returned to his own cabin, unaware that the microlens hidden in the ceiling had recorded their every move. Mixed emotions. The morning sun glared off the aft deck, forcing the passengers and crew of the William Beebe to squint. Jonas felt an ache in his chest and a harsh lump in his throat as Captain Morgan closed the prayer book, concluding the ceremony honoring their fallen shipmate. Mac grabbed Jonas's arm and pulled him aside, tears of anger welling in his eyes.
ETI made arrangements for me to pick up another chopper, but first I have to file a report with the FAA over yesterday's accident. Figure I'll be gone all day. When I get back, I want you to tell me how we're going to exterminate that fucking shark of yours.
Jonas nodded and watched him go. Jonas could sense Celeste approach from the aroma of jasmine lotion on her deeply tanned skin. A beige one-piece romper hung from her bared shoulders, the cut of her loose-fitting top revealing the inviting cleavage. She stood barefoot, a pair of sandals dangling from her fingers. Jonas caught himself staring. She didn't seem to mind.
Are you going somewhere? He asked.
We're meeting in 10 minutes in the galley. Since it looks like we're stuck in port for at least the next 15 hours, I thought you could help me pick up a few supplies in town.
I don't think I'd be much company. She looked up at him, her blue eyes glistening.
I'm upset, too. That's why I need to get off this boat for a few hours.
Let me think about it, he said, following her to the galley. Jonas nodded to the captain and Harry Moon, then set his breakfast tray on the table, taking an empty seat across from Dr. Marin. Celeste set her tray down next to him.
I'm having a GTI representative meet with Deef's family, Celeste said. They'll take care of funeral arrangements and other financial needs.
Celeste, the Tanaka Institute called, Captain Morgan said. They said your package should arrive on board sometime this evening.
What package? I've arranged for another of the Institute's Abyss gliders to be delivered. I know Deef's death is still on everyone's mind, but we'll need the sub to position the net beneath the Megalodon once she's captured.
And who do you expect to pilot the sub? Jonas asked.
I'll be piloting it, Marin said.
It's not like piloting the Alvin, Jonas said. Once the Meg's unconscious, you may have to descend 300 or 400 feet just to get the net beneath her.
I know what has to be done, Taylor. Celeste, can we dispense with a small talk and get this meeting started? Unlike some of you, I've got tons of work to do.
Celeste nodded. Start by bringing Jonas up to date. Marin rubbed his eyes. He looked hungover.
Short and sweet, we lost Sosus.
What's that mean? Jonas asked.
Lost, as in the signal no longer exists. The transmitter must have been torn away from the Megalodon's hide when she was struggling to break free from the trawl net. No matter, we'll find her.
Yeah, and how will we do that? Jonas asked.
We'll follow the coastline around Vancouver and Alaska until we track her down in the Bering Sea.
You think the Bering Sea's a fucking pond? How do you expect...
Celeste stopped him. Jonas, if I have to, I'll arrange a fleet of choppers to track her.
Might as well call out the Air Force while you're at it.
Christ, Celeste, this voyage could go on for months.
No thanks to you, Marin said a bit too loudly.
You're blaming me?
The plan worked perfectly. We had her trapped in the harbor. The shark was exhausted. Another 5 minutes and I would have harpooned her. If you hadn't ordered Celeste to remove the gill net...
The shark was attacking those rafts, Jonas said. If it hadn't been for Deef, a lot more people would have died.
I disagree, Marin said. The creature had already fed. It wasn't hungry. It only attacked the tall ship because it felt threatened. I don't know what you said to Diefendorf, but it was enough to send him into the sea with the sub. For all we know, the Abyss Glider may have actually spooked the creature.
And what's that supposed to mean?
It means that you panicked, Taylor. Had you said nothing to Deef, the William Beebe would have been able to rescue those passengers without the Megalodon going ballistic. And we still could have harpooned the creature, to say nothing about the fact that Diefendorf would still be alive.
Celeste watched Jonas's face turn red with anger.
But then you always seem to panic when it comes to these creatures, Marin said. And unfortunately, somebody always dies as a result.
Jonas lunged across the table and grabbed the young scientist by his shirt, lifting him clear out of his chair with both hands. Captain Morgan and Harry Moon intercepted Jonas, prying his fingers loose. Marin turned to Celeste, visibly upset.
Celeste, I've had enough of this guy's bullshit. If you want me to do my job, keep this baboon out of my way.
He glared at Jonas, straightened his torn shirt collar, and marched out of the galley. Jonas stormed out to the main deck, his hands trembling in anger. Celeste watched him go, then headed to Dr. Marin's room. Without bothering to knock, she opened the door. He was next to the bed, removing his torn shirt. She reached up and fingered his bruised throat. He gave her a boyish grin.
At this rate, I'm going to need a new wardrobe. So, did I do good?
You'll win the Oscar, she said.
And what happens when he bashes my skull in?
He won't, at least not when there's a crowd around. Stay to the high ground.
I'm not afraid of Taylor. It's his psycho friend MacReady's who bothers me.
Leave him to me. As for Jonas, I'll let you know when I want you to piss him off again.
Marin slipped his arm around Celeste's waist, pulling her close.
And what about us? You were supposed to come by my cabin last night. What happened?
She slid her hand over his crotch, giving him a playful squeeze.
I like to tease my prey before I eat them, she whispered, running the tip of her tongue along his bruised neck. Guess I wasn't hungry last night.
Celeste removed his hand from her waist, whispering into his ear.
Varium et mutabile semper femina.
Another one of your mentor's sayings?
It means woman is ever a fickle and changeable thing. Be patient with me, Michael, darling. I'm worth the wait.
In the meantime, redirect that libido of yours and help me recapture my fish. A cluster of television and newspaper reporters waiting on the wharf suddenly turned and ran in unison toward Jonas as he stepped out onto the main deck. Leaning over the starboard rail, they called out questions as the photographers clicked their cameras. Jonas ducked back inside the boat.
Going ashore, Taylor?
Jonas turned, startled by Harry Moon. Celeste asked me to help her run a few errands.
Then you'd better take this.
Harry handed him a cellular phone.
You've made a few more enemies over the last 24 hours. The ship-to-shore number's already programmed in memory. Just hit 1 and send. Check in with us every once in a while so we know you're okay.
Jonas pocketed the phone. Thanks. He watched Harry go as Celeste approached from the other end of the corridor.
Come with me into town, she said. Anything's better than dealing with the press.
Jonas nodded. Celeste took his arm, leading him to a launch docked along the William Beebe's portside bow. They climbed down into the craft and hid beneath a canvas rain cover as the driver started the boat's engines. 5 minutes later, they arrived, unnoticed, along the far side of the Westport Marina. For the next 6 hours, they visited wholesale purveyors, ordering supplies and arranging the goods to be delivered aboard the ship. By late afternoon, they had finished, stopping to rest at a park bench facing the ocean. The sun bathed the wharf in a golden light, casting a warm glow across Celeste's amber skin. Jonas watched as she fed popcorn to the seagulls.
I really needed to get off that boat, she said. Could I ask you one last favor? We passed a restaurant a few blocks back on West Haven Drive.
The Islander?
Yes. Let's go there for dinner. She smiled. It's on the company.
Okay.
You look tired. It's still early. Why don't you close your eyes for a few minutes and relax?
Jonas laid his head back and shut his eyes, the sound of the sea calming him. Within seconds, he was asleep. When he awoke, the sun had turned into a crimson ball, setting quickly along the horizon. Celeste was nuzzled against him. Have a nice nap? Jonas straightened himself and stretched, feeling refreshed.
God, it's so nice to fall asleep without having a nightmare.
See what happens when I watch over you?
They waited until the sunset had faded to violet, then headed to the restaurant. The maitre d' led them to a candlelit booth facing the water. Celeste leaned forward.
Jonas, I need to tell you something. I feel very comfortable around you, like I could talk to you about anything. I've never had that kind of relationship with a man before. You know I'm also very attracted to you.
I'm married.
Yes, but to be honest, are you happy? Is Terry happy?
We shouldn't be discussing this right now.
Why not? I told you personal things about my life.
Celeste, I love my wife. Is that so hard for you to understand?
No, but is it so hard for you to understand that Terry wants to move on?
Jonas picked up the menu, feeling uncomfortable. I had a nice time today. Why screw it up now?
I'm trying to help you.
No, you're trying to manipulate me into believing that Terry wants a divorce.
Celeste smiled.
Okay, I confess. I do have an ulterior motive. The truth is, I think you and I could be very happy together.
She glided her fingertips over the candle's flame.
Jonas, forget me for a moment. Just answer this question honestly. How did your first marriage end?
My first marriage? Why do you want to know about that?
Just answer the question. Did you leave her or did she leave you?
If you must know, she left me. She was having an affair with one of my best friends.
And why do you think that happened?
What are you getting at?
She reached forward and touched his hand.
What I'm about to say may seem harsh, but I want you to think about it. A woman's love dies for a man when her partner stops paying attention to her. Women like Terry need constant attention.
If you don't give it to them, they'll eventually find it from someone else.
I don't know what happened to your first marriage, but I think your marriage to Terry failed because you still feel guilty over what happened 11 years ago.
Jonas pulled his hand away. I feel guilty over a lot of things.
But 11 years ago was the quintessential moment in your life, the day your obsession with death first began. Two people died under your command. Knowing you, I'd say you probably blamed yourself for the deaths, and ruined your first marriage in the process. Then, 4 years ago, you refocused your guilt into hatred, blaming your misery on these sharks.
Jonas stared out the window. She died.
Who died?
Maggie, my first wife. She was killed 4 years ago by the Megalodon.
I'm sorry.
The waiter interrupted. Celeste ordered for both of them while Jonas continued staring at his dark reflection in the bay window.
Jonas, are you okay?
Can we talk about something else?
Okay.
She leaned forward.
Martin pissed you off earlier, didn't he?
The guy's an asshole.
Yes, but he's an intelligent asshole. I need him around until we recapture the creature.
And why do you need me around?
She smiled.
Martin's a boy. You're a man.
Jonas felt her toes rubbing against his calf.
Celeste, sorry.
She drained her glass.
How is Maseo Tanaka doing?
Not well.
Perhaps the stress of the Megalodon's escape was too much for him. Maybe he should retire.
I think the news of his daughter descending into the Mariana Trench is what triggered his heart attack, not the shark escaping.
Why should Tanaka be concerned about Terry? Doesn't he think the Benthos is his safe ship?
It's not the Benthos. His son DJ was killed in the trench 4 years ago.
Prastitya, I had completely forgotten.
Celeste picked at her Caesar salad.
Jonas, tell me, how many more of these sharks could really be down there?
I don't know. I'm sure there's a few.
And the Benthos? Is it vulnerable to attack?
I can't say. I know Benedict designed the vessel to take a beating, but who knows what else is in the abyss?
Now you've got me worried. The trench is so huge.
She paused, staring at her water glass.
Jonas, where was it that you first ran into the Megalodon?
You mean 4 years ago?
No, the very first time you saw one of the creatures. 11 years back, when you were piloting the Sea Cliff.
It was a remote location.
We nicknamed the site the Devil's Purgatory.
Her eyes lit up.
Devil's Purgatory? Do you remember the exact coordinates?
Yes, but I can't discuss it. The mission was classified, and the Navy's already pissed off enough at me.
You know I'm only interested because I'm worried about Benedict and the Benthos crew. Their family, all I have left. What if the Benthos is exploring the same area of the trench, this Devil's Purgatory?
What if they are?
Don't you think the chances of them running across another Megalodon may be greater? Don't you think we should warn them to stay away from that location?
There's no reason to think that area could be any more dangerous than another. Besides, I told you, I can't give out the coordinates.
But if another creature the size of Angel is down there...
Nothing as big as Angel's in the trench, that I can assure you.
But still, you said there may be other sharks. Jonas, I promise I won't tell a soul. I'm just worried.
Earlier I said I trusted you.
Don't you trust me?
It's not a question of trust, Celeste. Top secret means top secret. Maceo's like a father to me, but I couldn't reveal the coordinates to him either.
Fine.
She slammed down her fork.
Just forget I asked.
Don't be mad.
I am mad, and I'm disappointed. I thought we were friends.
We are.
If Macready's asked you for the coordinates, would you tell him?
Celeste, I don't understand how some obscure piece of information that's more than 11 years old could possibly hurt the United States Navy.
That's because you don't know what the mission was about.
I don't want to know what the mission was about. In fact, I couldn't care less. I told you, I'm just worried about the people on board the Benthos.
Terry, let's change the subject.
Celeste frowned.
You just called me Terry.
I did?
Jonas rubbed his eyes. I'm sorry, Freudian slip. I'm just real tired. Can we talk about something else?
I have a better idea. Let's not talk at all.
Harry Moon greeted them as they boarded the William Beebe.
What happened to all the reporters? Jonas asked.
Dr. Marin spoke with them briefly. Glad you're back. We're about ready to shove off. Marin's been driving the captain crazy since the new Abyss glider was delivered 2 hours ago. He was ready to send out a search party for the two of you. I think he's afraid the creature's getting too far ahead of us.
I pay Marin to worry, Celeste said.
Jonas reached into his pocket, removing the cellular phone Harry had given him earlier.
Just hang on to it for the duration of the trip, Harry said.
Jonas, I'm exhausted, Celeste said. Would you mind walking me to my cabin?
They strolled across the deck, pausing to admire the new Abyss glider, which had been assembled and mounted on its sled in the stern.
Jonas stared at the one-man sub, the blood draining from his face.
What the fuck is this thing doing on board?
What are you talking about?
Don't fuck with me, Celeste. You know damn well what I'm talking about. This is an AG-2, the deep water model. What the hell is it doing here? Did you order this?
Jonas, calm down. It was the only sub the Institute had available on short notice. It may not be as fast as the AG-1, but it'll still do the job. Is there a problem?
Hell yes, there's a problem. There's a big fucking problem. God damn it, Celeste, I told you about my nightmares, and now you've brought an AG-2 aboard. Are you toying with me?
Jonas,
that sub is my fucking coffin!
She grabbed him by the arm.
Stop this nonsense. It's not your coffin. You're not even the one who's going to be piloting it.
She followed him inside as the William Beebe's engines growled to life.
Jonas, wait. I'm sorry. Are you all right?
No. Do me a favor. Just leave me alone. I can't think straight.
Come with me, I know just what you need.
She led him to her cabin door.
Come in and have a quick drink, it will settle your nerves.
Not tonight.
Jonas, the night's still young. Allow me to apologize the right way.
She reached her hand around his waist, pressing her groin to his. Jonas pushed her away.
Don't. Look, I told you, I love Terry.
Did you also love your first wife after she stopped loving you?
Stay with me tonight, Jonas. You don't have to make love to me if you're not ready. Just let me watch over you while you sleep. I'll keep your nightmares away.
He stared at her, her breasts heaving, her lust intoxicating.
So beautiful. So dangerous.
She unbuttoned her shirt.
No one could love you the way I could, she whispered, reaching for his pants.
Jonas grabbed her wrists, feeling his own hands trembling with desire.
Knock it off, Celeste. This isn't going to happen.
I know you want me, Jonas.
Good night, Celeste. She watched him head down the hall.
Jonas, I bet you'll think of me tonight when you're alone.
Jonas ignored her. He pushed open his cabin door, not noticing Dr. Marin watching from the end of the corridor.
The Spider and the Fly. Mariana Trench. Heath Williams continued to search his computer files, frustrated at the lack of pertinent information available on ancient marine reptiles. At least he knew what monstrous prehistoric species the immense fossilized section of skull belonged to. Unfortunately, he also knew that wouldn't be enough for Benedict. He typed in another command, accessing Jonas Taylor's theories on Carcharodon Megalodon. He looked up to see Sergei enter the lab.
Sergei, back here.
Heath directed him into the back room and closed the door behind him. Hearing the door close, Terry sneaked out of the lab supply closet and into the outer corridor, heading up to the bridge to find Benedict.
"You wanted to speak?"
Sergei said, eyeing Heath suspiciously.
"Yes, I've now dated this fossil and completed my taxonomy work. Based on measurements of this skull, I'd say we're looking at a creature whose dimensions match those of the life forms that chased the Prometheus. I'm almost certain that the animals swarming after the sub come from the same lineage as this fossil. Benedict needs to know that we're dealing with pack hunters that are probably faster and more cunning than Carcharodon Megalodon, and perhaps even more dangerous. I strongly recommend that all future submersible missions into the trench be postponed until we can figure out a way of dealing with these creatures."
Sergei scoffed, already knowing Benedict's reply.
"You wish to board the Prometheus?"
Benedict's emerald eyes became laser beams, seeking to penetrate her innermost thoughts. Terry turned away from him to face the Lexan observation window. The bioluminescent creatures of the abyss twinkled in the pitch-black water like a bizarre night sky. "I know it seems like a strange request, given what happened yesterday, but I just feel like it's something I should do. What was it you said? Yield not to misfortune?" Benedict thumbed his goatee.
"And the presence of these mysterious life forms no longer bothers you?"
"Of course it bothers me," Terry said. "I have a healthy dose of fear, just like the crew of the Prometheus, but I'm not going to allow that to interfere with my responsibilities. I'm willing to face my fears."
"Fortune favors the brave, is that it?"
"If your men can do it, so can I. Of course, I'm not in it for the money."
"And you believe this is the reason my crew risks their lives for money?"
"I just assume so," she said. "Most of them don't appear to be scientists, so I'm guessing they're well-paid hired hands."
"Well-paid, yes, but what good is money if one is dead? You and I risk our lives because we believe in the humanity of our mission. These men are different, recruited for their talent, handpicked and trained by myself because their lives had long ago become meaningless, lacking all purpose and direction. They were lost souls, something you can't even begin to relate to. They had forfeited everything in life, their miserable existence without meaning or value. I gave them what they desperately needed, a reason to live." His eyes opened wide. "My presence now fills voids manifested through years of narcotics and alcohol and child abuse. I have shown them that an honorable death is better than a disgraceful life. In doing so, I became both their devil and their god, for they fear me as much as they love me. And that, my dear, is true power."
"So you prey on their fears, is that it?" Benedict stroked his goatee as if mulling it over.
"Do I prey upon their fears? Perhaps. Man, after all, is predatory by nature. After 2 million years of existence, we continue to slaughter ourselves, be it in the name of conquest or religion or some other justification, all of which are rooted in the power of fear."
"Don't these men have families?"
"I am their family. They will remain in my employment and care until the day they die."
"And Celeste?" Benedict shot her a malicious grin.
"Celeste is a different animal entirely."
"What if these men wanted to leave?"
"They could go if they wished. Those that have done so in the past quickly return to drugs or booze or whatever personal problem gave me cause to recruit them in the first place. Try to understand. The tragedy that befell these men robbed them of their self-discipline. I've given each a new lease on life. In exchange, they've turned their free will over to a higher power."
"Which is you?"
"Yes. I am like the spider. Having enticed the condemned fly into my web, I offer sweet salvation, but only within my web."
"Flies have no salvation in a spider web, only fear and death. If you ask me, your organization sounds more like a cult, and you're nothing more than another megalomaniac running it."
"Please, if you wish to parley, then kindly shunt the emotional side of your brain so we may converse like intellectuals. Like all true leaders, I am first and foremost a student of human nature."
Benedict moved toward the immense Lexan window, staring into the abyss.
"Have you ever wondered how certain men throughout history, despite every conceivable hardship, managed to rise above their peers to change the world? Genghis Khan, Napoleon, Lenin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein, these men all understood fear, a state of mind so powerful that it can move mountains and land a man on the moon just as easily as it can obliterate a person's resistance with but a single negative thought."
He turned to face her.
"What is it that man truly fears? Poverty? Criticism, ill health, loss of a loved one, old age? Of course, let's not forget the ultimate fear, death. Think about it. Without fear, we'd have no need for religion or war. Then again, fear is the great motivator, isn't it? Had only man never experienced fear, we would have never developed as a species.
Are you saying that you have no fear?
Benedict shook his head. I have mastered my fear, but it will never be absent. Courage and understanding, that is the key. Fear is nothing more than the dark side of thought. It has substance only in the mind. We create it, and we alone can destroy it. But because most men never master their fear, they spend their lives living in its thrall. My crew follows me into the depths of hell because they fear my wrath more than anything else they can imagine.
What the hell did he do to instill such fear? Terry smiled nervously. Look, I just came to ask you if it would be all right to spend my last day in the abyss aboard the Prometheus. If it's a problem.
Fear makes us do things we might never agree to do, doesn't it, my dear?
I really don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I think you do, he said, drawing closer. I can smell your fear. It paralyzes your thoughts, your ability to think, to reason.
He stood over her, his penetrating gaze fracturing her will.
You're afraid, aren't you? Afraid of what Sergei may do when he finds you alone.
Yes, she confessed. Can't you keep him away from me?
Sergei is an animal. I've warned him, but he feeds off your fear. It intoxicates him as much as his alcohol. You must learn to focus your energy on solutions, not the problem itself.
Solutions? Give me a gun and I'll blow his head off. How's that for a solution?
And spend the rest of your life in prison? I think not. Sergei is not your true enemy, Terry. Fear is. It will steal your willpower, diminish your strength, immobilize your defenses. To control it, you must first understand it, recognize its subtleties, and find its weakness.
I don't understand. Benedict moved closer. He took her hand in his, rubbing the sweat along her open palm with his thumb.
Fear creates stress, which in turn causes a series of physiological changes to occur. Heart rate and breathing increase, raising the oxygen supply and pumping more blood to the muscles. Blood sugar rises, increasing energy. The pupils dilate, improving vision, while the flow of neurotransmitter secretions increases to improve the speed of reactions. Nature designed these physiological changes for primitive man to survive in the jungle, to fight back when challenged. But the evolution of our species only took place when we learned how to engage our mind. The challenges facing civilized man are more emotional than physical. When confronted with obstacles, our society of weaklings tends to choose flight over fight. Instead of focusing on solutions, modern man chooses to escape reality, and the battle is lost before it has ever begun. Flight becomes fright. Drugs and alcohol subdue the physiological changes of fear, but in doing so, dull the thought process. Succumbing to our fears, we disarm ourselves of the one tool that can lead us to victory, the very process necessary for solutions, and the one that brought our species out of the jungle in the first place.
Benedict released her hand.
The true battle is here, in the mind, he said, pointing to her temple. Force your mind to create solutions. Face your fear, and defeat it.
He started down the access tube, then stopped.
You and I both know the true reason you wish to join us this morning aboard the Prometheus. Choosing the lesser of two evils is not always the best way to live one's life, but under the circumstances, it may be your best solution. Therefore, the invitation is extended. We depart in 15 minutes.
10 minutes later, Terry descended to G-Deck, still uncertain whether she was intending to board the Prometheus or not. She followed the long white corridor toward the docking bay, then stopped. Down the hall to her right, Sergei was swiping his magnetic pass card across the security lock of the vault-like storage room. He saw her just as he was about to enter. Face your fears. Terry forced herself to continue walking. Sergei waited, leering at her.
Wipe that shit-eating grin off your face, she said. Fuck with me and you're fucking with Benedict.
Sergei stopped smiling. Terry continued past him, exuding attitude, then entered the docking area, her heart racing wildly. Taking several deep breaths, she descended into the Prometheus. Benedict looked up from his charts as she climbed down into the cabin.
Captain, our last passenger has arrived. Take us out. Aisha, rig ship for dive.
Benedict continued leaning over the light table, his eyes glittering up at her. Perhaps it was the emerald eyes, or perhaps the mouth that hung open in a frozen smile. But for a moment, Benedict's hairless face appeared like the head of a snake, poised to strike.
"Welcome to my web," said the spider to the fly.
I'm not here because I'm afraid, she lied. Since I'll be returning topside tomorrow, this will be my last day in the abyss, my last chance to explore the trench.
Of course. You're here because you want to be here, even though death may arrive at a moment's notice. Ah, but the madness of one person drives many mad.
Do you object?
Not in the least. As I stated earlier, your presence is welcome.
He flashed her a Cheshire Cat smile.
Moraturi te salutamus. We who are about to die salute thee.
Without asking, she took her place at the computer station. Moments later, the deep-sea submersible pulled away from its docking bay and glided into the trench. For the next 4 hours, the Prometheus moved through darkness, dropping to the seafloor every kilometer or so to extract a sample of sediment and rock.
Each sample will be examined on board the Benthos by our geologists, Benedict had explained. Results of the tests help us map out the trench while determining which terrains are best suited to support the next series of Eunice robots.
Fighting drowsiness, Terry stretched, then made her way aft to the bathroom. She closed the door and stared at her reflection in the mirror.
Hang in there, girl, she said aloud. By this time tomorrow, you'll be back on board the Goliath, then on your way home to Jonas.
She relieved herself, then washed her face. Without warning, the submersible suddenly turned hard to starboard, tossing her sideways against the aluminum storage locker. Regaining her feet, she hurried from the bathroom as the vessel turned once more. Standing between the radio man and sonar, Benedict had a tense look on his face. The other members of the crew were watching him.
What's happening? She asked one of the men.
The Goliath located the creatures. Instead of going after us, they're heading for a location between us and the Benthos. Looks like they finally figured out how to isolate us.
Terry took her seat, the news draining her of her strength. Does Benedict fear death? She stared at him, the expression on his face exuding annoyance.
4 objects now on sonar, sir. 2 kilometers and closing from the north. Benthos still a good 5 kilometers behind them.
The seaman looked up.
They've got us, sir. Stay focused, gentlemen, Benedict said.
Minutes passed in silence. The cabin grew warm, the air heavy with the pungent scent of perspiration.
Life forms approaching 70 yards to starboard. Stand by. Sir, 3 of the 4 just broke from the pack, closing quickly. The 4th is circling behind us.
Intelligent creatures, Benedict muttered.
Helm, stay on course.
Aye, sir.
Terry's eyes strained to penetrate the darkness. Unable to see ahead, she focused on the beam of light aimed at the passing seafloor. Seconds later, she was startled to witness a prodigious girth glide into view beneath the sub. The flattened mud-brown dorsal surface of the immense head appeared first, the skull as large as the Prometheus's bow. 2 forefins, which were attached to a streamlined body, tapered back, ending with 2 paddling hind limbs and a short but muscular tail.
"It just passed under the sub!" she yelled.
The closest crewman turned.
"You saw it? How big?"
"As wide as the sub, nearly as long. It moved through the water like a giant crocodile."
Without warning, the Prometheus was slammed broadside. Terry was thrown sideways against the window, smashing her elbow hard against the titanium plating.
"Benthos now 3 kilometers to the south. ETA 7 minutes.
The sub lurched forward, jolted from behind.
"Captain, one of the creatures is attacking the screw. I'm losing helm control."
An insane screech of metal filled the cabin. The sub began rolling to port, then shuddered, the interior lights flickering off. Enveloped in suffocating darkness, Terry covered her ears against the deafening shrill of the damaged screw. The screeching ceased. Terry felt the sub dropping. Grabbing the armrests of her seat, she nearly wrenched them off. Her breathing became labored, sweat pouring down her face, her skin crawling in the pitch-dark cabin as the Prometheus fell to the bottom of the world.
"Screw's completely gone, sir,"
a shaken crewman called out.
"We're dead in the water."
"Release ballast plates."
"Belay that, Captain,"
Benedict yelled.
"We'll be safe on the bottom."
Dropping between 2 black smokers, the sub plowed bow first into the seabed. The rest of the hull struck bottom seconds later. Terry began hyperventilating as the vessel came to a complete stop, resting in silence and blackness on the floor of the 7-mile-deep trench. A backup generator switched on, bathing the cabin in red light. Terry felt a prodigious force nudging the outer plates. She glanced out her window, stifling a scream. An iridescent crimson eye the size of a grapefruit peered in at her.
"Mr. Singer, hull temperature exceeding 280 degrees and rising fast. These vents will cook us."
Here comes the Benthos! Sonar called out. Sir, the creatures are scattering!
Terry wiped tears from her eyes as she breathed a sigh of relief.
Captain?